Hi, this is Steve. If you're a regular listener of Navigating Life as We Know It, and you visit our Facebook page, you're probably aware that everyone in our household was visited by the COVID-19 virus right before Christmas. I would have preferred Santa left coal in our stockings. COVID is a real thing, it's nasty, and although we fortunately did not have severe cases to deal with, I would encourage everyone to mask up, take social distancing seriously, and strongly consider vaccination when it becomes available. You just don't want to catch this thing. Meanwhile, I also want to thank you for your patience. It's been a long time since we had a chance to sit down and record an interview and share it with you. In the summer of 2020, y'all remember that summer that didn't really happen? We visited with Dr. Michael Wolf and physical therapist Sean Cowell at Brains in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Our discussion was focused on the first episode of their Effective Parenting series, titled The Fundamentals of Autism. After introducing our guests, we begin with a discussion of the history and diagnostic criteria of autism. Today we're visiting with Brains and neuropsychologist Dr. Michael Wolf and occupational therapist Sean Crowell about a parent workshop created by Brains called Putting the Pieces Together. Our conversation today is based upon the first workshop in the series, The Fundamentals of Autism. Welcome, Sean, and welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
I really love your mission statement because it is so inclusive. Maximizing potential of families through understanding the complex relationships between body, brain, and real life. It's not just the person with autism. And it can one of you tell me about your big-hearted brain, Stuff the Bus? That sounds like a lot of fun.
So Stuff the Bus, we've done this every year with the United Way now for about 4 years. 3-4 years is when they started it. And it's an opportunity for us to support our local schools by reaching out, donating to them school supplies, pencils, pens, erasers, paper, backpacks, and things that they need for underserved students going into the schools so that they have the opportunities to have the supplies to do their homework, to perform in the classroom environment.
Well, you got some great pictures on your website, and it looks like people are having fun. Dr. Wolf, let me ask you, your biography, and I'm looking at the professional biography, I got the personal biography part of it. You said you're from Minnesota.
Yep.
Did you use speech therapy to lose the accent or what?
No. And you'll hear my no right there, actually. If you catch me talking to my family,
yeah,
you will hear a very strong Minnesotan accent in my family.
Well, because you're back in that milieu, right?
But, yes.
See, I grew up in Chicago, and I had a lot of friends in Wisconsin. You're just like Wisconsin with a twang because you're farther west.
That's right. We got the Norwegian
Minnesota
to it.
Right?
That's right. Although, if you're really from Minnesota, we're going to call it Minnesota.
Minnesota? Yeah, right. It's like, well, that's, you know, we have the UP. It's about the same thing.
Yes.
And there's a lot of things. You said you like to work with your hands and stuff, and I really appreciate that. It's kind of nice when you work with your head a lot to get out there and build something.
Yes, it is.
And if you grew up in rural Minnesota on a farm, I guess that was expected.
That was my expected life, was to be a farmer, or at least my hope. But neuropsychology came into play somewhere along that line.
Well, you're planting other things. You're just planting ideas instead.
I thought it was pseudo-psychology.
It is.
Pseudo-psychology.
Yes, we tease about that I have boarding in the American Academy of Pediatric Pseudo-Psychology. So, yeah.
What is pseudo-psychology?
So it's not. We've had some individuals here who didn't understand board certification. And they said, well, isn't that the guy that's got the pseudo-psychology? Because it's ABPDN.
Okay.
And they didn't know what that extra P stood for in there. And so we've had to correct some individuals and laugh about that. But if I get the opportunity to use it and say, well, this is on you guys because I'm just a pseudo-psychologist, it certainly takes some pressure off of me.
The next question is, what exactly is neuropsychology? Because people are used to the term psychologist, but a neuropsychologist.
So neuropsychology is a specialization of trying to understand the influences of the brain and how the brain's functioning and then how that relates to what we see in everyday behavior or activity. So it was originally came out of the rehabilitation model. How does traumatic brain injury and seizures and different influences that we could see happening in the brain then influence functioning? And it's evolved since then to look at more of the other aspects where there might not be anything functionally wrong with your brain, but it doesn't mean it's always working optimally. And so we can look at now the centers of functioning, from general intellect to speech to visual spatial skills, some motor abilities, executive functioning, attention, concentration, and memory. And how do those things then feed into the aspects of functioning in anyone's given day?
So it's more like
how your body uses that with behavior rather than just psychology.
Right.
One step further. Sean, okay, you were born in Nevada but grew up in Southwest Michigan.
That's right. So I miss mountains big time.
I bet.
I miss Lake Tahoe. Yeah, so Nevada was kind of where I grew up. And about the age of 14, I followed my family out here, went through high school here. And then shortly after, I joined the service, spent a couple of years in the Air Force, and for some stupid reason, I came back home, moved back in with my mom, which was a terrible decision.
We have to make some bad ones, and right, what a good one looks right.
Yep, I'll never make that mistake again. Shortly realized that I was going to use my GI Bill to go to school and looked at occupational therapy, and Western had a really, really top-notch program. I was fortunate enough to get in there, and, you know, after I graduated, I shortly came across Brains, and just like you, that the mission statement really spoke to me. Mm-hmm. That mind-body connection and helping the families realize the potential of it. And, you know, I was sold from the second I read that, and that's kind of how I ended up here at Brains.
And it says that you were going to school full-time and working a full-time job and also raising your firstborn child.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's an accumulation of being stupid or just really good at working hard.
I did the same thing.
Yeah.
I was a sophomore in college when I was married and had a child, and I was commuting from Palos Heights, Illinois, which is down the southwest side, up to Oak Park for school every day. I went to Concordia in River Forest. And so like an hour and a half each way and working. So I'm thinking, I know this guy.
Yeah. It wasn't
planned. He's my life right here.
It wasn't planned that way.
Yeah.
My wife was also in school full time, working part time. And it just, you know, it was a blessing in disguise. You know, when it first happened, we thought, how are we going to get through this? There's no way. We're going to have to put some life goals on hold. But, you know, we just kind of put our head down and kept putting one foot in front of the other. And here we are.
Well, you know, it gives you experience, and you certainly know about stress now, don't you?
Yes. Okay. Character building.
Yeah, right. Dr. Wolf, can you tell us what the ADDM network is? I'm not familiar with that acronym.
So it stands for the Autism and Developmental Disability Monitoring Network that's set up by the Center for Disease Control to start estimating prevalence rates for autism spectrum disorders throughout the United States.
So it's a bunch of organizations throughout the United States that are monitoring not just autism, but developmental disabilities also.
Good question. So it is a monitoring network. It doesn't necessarily mean it's our organizations. It might be universities. It might be health centers that are pooling data and sending that to the Center for Disease Control to figure out what is the census rate, essentially, of autism spectrum disorders from those regions. And so when we're looking at some of those regions, places like Minnesota, Wisconsin, Arizona, California, and on the East Coast, we have some in New Jersey, and they're taking about 8 centers throughout the nation that have a variety of different types of populations and trying to see what's happening in those populations with the prevalence rates for autism spectrum disorders. And that's where we get those numbers coming away from. Initially back in the late 90s, 1 in 500 children might have an autistic spectrum disorder. Then we move into the 2000s, and we're looking at 1 in 100, maybe 1 in 150 children. And then when we move forward to today, seeing that sometimes, for males, maybe as many as 1 in 50, 1 in 60 or something like that might have some type of autism spectrum disorder that's being diagnosed. So it's from those sites and those regions that they're able to grab data and then analyze what's happening and then come up with prevalence rates.
But that 1 in 59 for males could include everything from the highest level of function to the lowest level of function.
That is correct. Anyone who's been diagnosed on the spectrum would be included in that prevalence rate.
And now, when these different centers are getting information, they're getting it from doctor's offices, hospitals, how do they?
So they're choosing sites that they believe are going to provide diagnostic accuracy. So they're probably not going to grab as much data from the outpatient physician who may have completed a quick screen like an MCHAT, and then said, oh, well, this must be autism. Instead, they're going to look for the autism specialty centers in those regions who are using more rigorous diagnostic tools to assess, is this an autism spectrum disorder, and taking the data from those when we have diagnostic confirmation, both ruling out other medical factors that might be accounting for the ASD, ruling out other factors of neurodevelopmental disorders, looking at cognitive factors, although you can still have an intellectual disability and still be on the spectrum, we know. but making sure that it's not better accounted for exclusively by the intellectual disability, but there's in fact autism symptoms on top of the intellectual disability. So they're pulling it from usually regional college centers who have expertise and research grants in autism, who are going to be then fielding the diagnostics as accurately as we can.
That must require a heck of a lot of testing. And to make sure they're getting compatible data from all these different centers, the same kind of diagnosis to know what is similar and what is not.
Yeah. So usually the federal government and National Institute of Mental Health will set battery standards for what we're looking at in terms of diagnostic delineation. And so in this case, there'll usually be obviously the interview with the family, knowing the child's development. They'll be looking at either an autism diagnostic interview plus in some sort of structured testing with the child. Maybe the autism diagnostic observation system or something else that they'll put forth as saying these are approved measures that can help us look at diagnostic confirmation.
Had they been able to tell yet, you said it was like 1 in 500 and now it's 1 in 150 and it keeps getting looking worse and worse. Is that because of an increase in autism or better diagnostics to diagnose autism cases?
So we still don't know. I mean, it's such a dynamic question. Yeah. We do know that with more awareness of, and you know, with the Obama administration kind of putting forth this idea that we have an epidemic on our hands here with autism spectrum disorders, people started to pay more attention to these symptom profiles. So it might be in part awareness. We also know that there's also motivation behind money and health benefit to the diagnosis of an autism spectrum disorder. If you have a general neurodevelopmental disorder, meaning your child just isn't progressing as you might like them to, and they have delays, that's usually self-pay. There's no coverage or there's no benefit for that. But if you are on the spectrum now, the autism spectrum, your insurance may well pick up that occupational speech therapy, ABA services, and different types of coverage benefits that you wouldn't otherwise get. Plus, educational systems now usually have more opportunity for children who are on the spectrum, especially if you're in the moderate to lower functioning side of the spectrum, not the higher edge necessarily. But to say, well, we can have not only them in this classroom, but we also now have these other services, the OT, the PT, the speech, and inclusion programs and social skills programs. And a lot of kids would benefit from those. But if you're a child that doesn't have an ASD, that is an exclusion. So it might be the result of some financial reward. But then we also have to look at what's happening in our culture. We do know that toxicity may have something to do with autism spectrum disorder. We're now moving to more urban centers. Where there are things like pollution-related factors that can be problematic. Oxidative stress theories in terms of how metals and different things might get in could be an influential factor. Lots of our parents are having children later now. You know, back in our early history, we may have been looking at, you know, parents who are becoming parents, you know, 15, 16, and, you know, through their early 20s was normal. Now are having individuals maybe not have children until their mid to late 20s and sometimes into their 30s. And we do know that, you know, parents who are older that are having children have a higher risk of those children having a neurodevelopmental disorder or an autism spectrum disorder in particular. And so maybe that's part of the factor.
We'll never find one factor that counts for most of it. It's going to be a combination of factors probably.
It is very heterogeneous, that's for sure. And yeah, there's going to be multiple complicated factors that are all kind of put in the pot. But we know that even when we put all those kids in the pot and we say they're, this is an autism spectrum disorder pot, each of those children in the pot still are very unique and very dynamic in and of themselves. And unfortunately, you know, for our higher functioning ASD individuals, they're not as likely to be diagnosed as fast. And so we're going to see them being misdiagnosed with ADHD or bipolar or other things. So they might have gone on a journey that took them down detrimental pathways that really wasn't beneficial care for them and maybe had some detrimental qualities before. Now they're a little bit older, so we're not catching them as fast. And now they're in their, you know, late elementary, early teen types of years, middle school years, sometimes even later. But now they don't trust the world because no one's really ever understood me. And I can talk and I can communicate. And I told you this made me feel worse or I didn't really like that. But you didn't believe me because the professional said this was bipolar. So now I needed a medication that made me feel bad or add weight or made me sedate. And then I couldn't keep up with my work. And then I got in trouble for that. And so we see some other additive factors sometimes for individuals that aren't diagnosed with an ASD until a little bit later. But misattribution might have caused mistreatment earlier.
Well, and I'm sure you've had some of them here.
Lots, almost every day.
It's easy to see how someone would be mistrusting if nobody listened to them.
Absolutely.
Because there's three different levels of autism. And I just wonder, it's like one is requiring support, two is requiring substantial report, and three is very substantial. Is there a 2.75?
You know, we wish there were.
It seems to me that it's not like, oh, you're crossing over to number two now.
Yeah.
That there's got to be, within the spectrum, there's a spectrum.
Yes. And within the levels, there's a continuum.
Yeah.
But you do have to pick a number. And that number,
which
you know,
is most like.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. It's how do they function most of their time within any given day type of interaction. And so even though you could be a 1.35, which would essentially mean most of the time, you're functioning quite well, and you really don't need a lot of support. There just might be things or circumstances that you don't handle very well. But if more often than not, you need more support, you need OT or speech, or you need help with your ADLs, or if you need that help getting on the bus because you just can't quite figure out how to get on it, where to sit, now there's all these noises, and how do I manage all these noises, and now I have a behavioral reaction, you might be a level two. But now if that behavioral reaction becomes, now I'm hitting other kids or I'm screaming and yelling and I just can't deal with this at all and I need a lot of support. And maybe this bus isn't even right for me. I need to be on a bus where there's fewer people or someone to pick me up individually or drive me to school individually. Well, now we're probably at level three. And so it's where do you function most of the time? And it's an estimation of essentially that goal is in terms of how you're functioning. Most of the time, are you at a level one, a level two, or level three.
And it could vary by the environment you happen to be in at the time.
Absolutely, yes. Which is why it's, you know, where you're at a majority of the time.
Right.
Not necessarily just an environment, but in terms of functioning. You know, if you're at home, you might act one way, school another way, try to do something after school or at grandma's house or at the store, might be another way. But what's the most prevalent level that we're seeing? And with that then gets tagged often, what type of treatment might you qualify for? And if you're level one, insurance might say, well, level ones don't need ABA, so you don't get ABA. You have to be a level two or maybe a level three in order to get ABA. But at level one, you can get outpatient counseling, and that's going to be good enough for you. And so the levels do sometimes have some important factor to them in terms of opportunity for insurance coverage for symptomology.
Yeah, I've heard parents talk about that in terms of ABA.
Yep.
Not qualifying or qualifying.
Yep. Because it might just be too good if you're level one at that time that the clinician makes that judgment that says, hey, you're having a good day. And what I've heard for the last couple of months, you've been doing great. You know, 6 months ago, you were probably level two or level three. And maybe you should have had ABA back then. But now that you're out of school and you don't have those pressures and, you know, your family's supposed to homeschool you, but no one's grading you. So they didn't make you really do your homework.
Yeah.
And you don't have to put these new clothes on that make you uncomfortable every day. Well, shoot, for the last, you know, 3 to 4 months here, you're level one. So now the family's like, well, we can't get that help that we were really looking for. Well, you're right, because now your child's actually being cocooned because of a pandemic here that made them at the time of assessment, everything's going pretty good. But yeah, 4 or 5 months later, if things change, we can see that decline in functioning. And then it's usually follow-up consultation to say, what's happened? Is this more of a permanent change or just something that's happened in a day or a
week? So that status could change based upon
it can
going
change.
Back later on. And yeah. I mean, well, it can change for the insurance purposes.
Yes, yes, yeah. It can change. And that's an important thing that families don't often realize is if we say they're level one, they might think this is their now permanent state, they're high functioning and everything's fine. But that can change by many different dynamic life factors. And at some point, they may, in fact, decline in that need for level of support.
Question here was, how do these three levels affect educational services received? I think we already covered that.
To some extent, yeah. So if you're level three, you're probably going to be in a categorical placement, an autism impaired or an autism spectrum disorder classroom, with maybe some push-in or some gen ed participation, but it might not be as much because you might not be communicating. You might not really have that interest to advance. You might, well, in all likelihood, if you're level three, there's probably some level of intellectual disability that's going to coincide with that. If you're level two, now the school is going to have a tough time making a decision for you. Level two, they might say, well, yeah, given the fact that they're non-compliant, don't really want to do their work, they need some more individualized support, they may also be put in some type of special education environment. That might not be the autism spectrum sort of classroom. It might be resource room support. But they're realizing we can't just keep them in gen ed and in that mainstream classroom, because they're not really going to accomplish very much, or it might cause more disruption for both them and the classroom. So we're going to do a little bit more of both, but they might not need the AI room. Now they might be in resource room. Level ones, it can be very difficult for schools to say that they're going to offer them an IEP, an individualized education plan. They might offer them a 504 plan, or they might say, well, we're going to offer some accommodative supports unofficially and not go through the process of developing a plan, because they're getting, you know, C's and above, and they're not causing a disruption in the classroom, and they're doing the basics. And so we're just going to let them keep going in gen ed. And some of those kids obviously won't qualify for any supports, even though we know there's an autism spectrum disorder that has been diagnosed and could benefit from support. But academically, it's not impairing in a way that the school will say they require some type of formal plan.
How many people fall through the cracks?
A ton.
Yeah.
We a lot of our children, more often than not, on that higher functioning edge, which, by the way, there is no scientific definition of what high functioning is. It's an assumption of ability or functioning that we use that terminology. Mm-hmm. But if they can walk and they can talk and they can get their grades and they're generally making the strides alongside of things, the problem is with a lot of our individuals that we coin high functioning, when high school ends, a lot of them have an exceedingly difficult time going into college or going into life and getting that job, because we haven't had the opportunity to teach them how to function in the world. They can function within the structure of a particular environment. But we see kids so often, you know, they were doing good enough and, you know, everything seemed to be all right, but now the family can't get them out of their home and they're addicted to video games.
And they can't qualify for disability either.
Nope.
The services that go along with it. So.
That's exactly right. And so it becomes very challenging at that point in time to try to backfill skills that they need to launch into life, especially now that they're thinking, I'm 18. You can't tell me what to do anymore. I'm smart enough to know what this means. So I'm going to do my own thing. And really, a lot of them end up being either hermits or, you know, living with their parents or living in a squalor in some sense that isn't fair to them, but they can't really meaningfully take care of themselves because they never developed those skill sets to do that yet.
You had three other points on that category. It says schools do not base services on diagnosis. Is this on functionality?
Yes.
Okay.
So schools, and we know this from lots of diagnoses, many kids can have depression, anxiety, ADHD, a learning disability, or an autism spectrum disorder. And it's graded on how does that influence you in your academic performance. So even if an outpatient center or a hospital or someone has diagnosed an autism spectrum disorder, it doesn't mean that they'll qualify for school supports. It's, is this academically influential? And if so, is it something that would benefit from supports? And at times they'll give supports, but if they're not making the gains they should, there might be a definition or a line that the school might put in place to say, well, this is maybe kind of that maximal level of gain. And so we're going to titrate those services back. And now this is just kind of where we expect them to perform. So they do have to make progress within the academic environment based off the IEP particularly the IEP, because 504 is not going to be that closely monitored. But yeah, it's not diagnostic driven in schools. They do have to have these criteria, which are usually based on diagnoses. But then there's the additive factor. Do those diagnoses then influence what they're doing within the academic arena?
I remember when our son was in school and going through all the IEPs, and they had PT and OT, and we always thought that was great, but it was really educationally based. And I could see that from one of your points here, too. The school services address academic educational skills, not life functioning skills.
Right.
So basically, the PT was there to make sure he could sit up at the desk, but not to optimize his gait or walking or anything else. That was just so he can sit there at the desk,
right,
or in his wheelchair at the desk. So I think sometimes parents get a little confused as to what is and what could be. A PT or an OT like Sean would really take it much, much further than what they get in the school setting. But we think we're getting something really great in the schools.
And it's, you know, freely accessible if they're offered it in the school. So there's no copay, there's no deductible. And we assume if it's called OT or if it's called speech, that's what they would do in the outpatient world. But yes, just like your point says, that is far from the truth. And in fact, I had a conversation with a family this morning. They have a 7-year-old child who has an autism spectrum disorder and seizures. And the kid can write his name at 7. It looks like I might see a preschooler write their name. And right before the pandemic had hit, and schools closed, his occupational therapy services were discontinued because now he was able to write his name. But when we think of it at 7, you shouldn't be able to just write your name. You should be able to do your spelling words and possibly take some early notes and start to organize your math and do so much more than that. But in this case, that was the apparent definition that particular school had used to say, well, if you can do this, then we can assume that there's these other things you can do. But when we tested it Still couldn't do it fluently. Still couldn't manipulate to even draw basic shapes in a clear manner. Even a circle was partially unrecognizable as a circle. But yeah, after training through enough time, the basic letters of his name were fine. When I tried to say, can you just write all the letters of the alphabet? I don't care if they're capital or lowercase. I would probably say over 55% or more. I think I estimated at 70% actually, were unrecognizable letters. So I'm telling the family, you need OT, but you're going to have to go to an outpatient service center for that because the school has made that determination. Now, we can still repetition and review that IEP with the school, but that's going to take time. And all the while, these things are going to affect play skills and throwing and other types of fine motor coordination that your kid will avoid using silverware, helping with the dishes, doing particular types of chores because of these fine motor difficulties. But the school is not going to really pay as much attention to those at all because they're looking at what's needed for academic functioning.
Which I think is important for listeners to realize because if you're like we were and thought, well, he's getting OT and PT. Yes, and there's nothing wrong with the limitations of what they're doing there.
Yeah, there's particular boundaries and jobs that each person kind of has. And like you just mentioned, you know, the OT at the school, it's not that they're bad OT or a bad speech. They're well-trained professionals, but they have to work within the guidelines of the profession that they're doing in that work environment. And so their goals are going to be fundamentally different than the goals of what you do in an outpatient.
That's an important point to understand.
Thank you for tuning in to Navigating Life as We Know It. This is Alex, your producer and occasional long-distance communications officer here with your mid-break announcements. First off, thank you so much for your patience during the recovery period. Fortunately, it seems that most of us have come out of this virtually unscathed. So that's a victory there. But as Steve said in the beginning, this is still a pretty nasty thing. So if you have been able to avoid things thus far, keep up the good work. We will be doing a few more visits with Brains and have more information from them as time goes on. They have a wonderful program there, and if you'd like to know more about it, please tune in to our website or our Facebook page. We will be posting information there. Lastly, we have a new program we are developing here at Navigating Life as We Know It. It's something we're calling our Stage 2 episodes, and the first one to come out will be split into two, and it will be airing on the 17th and 24th of February. What it is a discussion with Social Security, trying to understand the program and some of the myths that need to be debunked about it. We will be doing more episodes like this in the future, but the catalyst for these episodes is you, our listeners, giving us feedback about what you want us to find out for you. So please take a moment and join our Facebook community, hop onto our page and see what's new, and if you're feeling like it, you can join our webpage or sign up on Patreon to help support the show. Thank you for your time. Have a wonderful listening experience.
Well, welcome back. Now we move on to overcoming barriers within the family dynamic. And it starts out with the mind-body connection. And I just wanted to read one quote from your presentation here. The brain and peripheral nervous system, the endocrine and immune system, indeed all the organs of our body and all the emotional responses we have share a common chemical and electrical language that are constantly communicating with one another. That explains the term hangry, doesn't it? And it says ASD individuals tend to have sensitivities in the mind-body interaction system. Could you explain how that works?
Yeah, so we know that their brains are wired a little differently, right? Some things go a little bit faster, some things go a little bit slower, some things don't really register, or some things register a lot, and specifically in a couple different areas. So sensory processing is kind of the big one. We know digestion is a huge challenge for a lot of families. Muscle, when we talk about like tone and our ability for our body to be prepared for movement. And then sleep. Sleep is that real big one that a lot of kiddos struggle with. And that one's most important when we talk about recovering and processing everything that goes through the day and kind of storing that stuff away to use the following day. And I think it kind of goes back to our two different nervous systems. So we have our sympathetic nervous system. That's kind of the fight or flight, as everybody knows it. You know, that's when we're in stress, our sympathetic nervous system is going. And then the opposite, you have your parasympathetic nervous system. And that's responsible for things like digestion, relaxation. We know kiddos who have autism tend to stay in that sympathetic state a little bit more. And if you think about trying to go to sleep when you're stressed, it doesn't really work. And if you do fall asleep, you're probably waking up shortly after, whether it's your brain just kind of just won't settle down, or, you know, the body just wants to move because we're in that state of stress. You know, it really does inhibit our ability to sleep. But it's tough to know exactly why. And with some of these kiddos, they can't really explain what they're feeling. And so as a clinician, a lot of problem solving there, especially with parents. You know, they're the ones, I don't get to see them sleep. And so when we're trying to remediate sleep or increase it, parents are huge because I can't always be there. I don't always know what's going on. And it the other challenge to that is a lot of times parents don't have the skilled eyes that myself or another clinician might have. And so they might miss something that otherwise would be a big hit for me and an answer to something. But yeah, sleep, it's just so important. And we know those kids don't get enough.
It could be hard to identify something that might have happened at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Right. It's affecting sleep now because right. The parents might not have been there either.
And so we talk about antecedents. I love our ABA team. You know, they're really good at recognizing what happens before, you know, a meltdown or whatever kind of behavior we're looking at. And antecedents are so hard to pay attention to and to know, because like you said, it could be a couple hours earlier that caused this reaction that we're having. So love our ABA team for that.
And I'll jump in too.
Sure.
You know, having the opportunity to have OT and ABA here, but also some things that we commonly overlook when we're thinking about ASD children, sometimes they need that weighted blanket because they're looking for some compression or proprioceptive feedback. Sometimes the blankets are uncomfortable, or again, they're too hot or too cold within their sleep. A lot of our ASD children also, even shortly after birth, struggle to monitor or manage their own circadian rhythms. And so they, you know, might want to lay close to their parents. And a lot of them might sleep with their parents for longer periods of time too. But then they rely on that adult as kind of their rhythming. And then when we try to move them into that bed themselves, that can take a long time to grab a hold of. And some of the research even done at Helen Voss Children's Hospital, sometimes children as, you know, young as 7 or 8, if they're not moving into their own rhythms and their own sleep cycles and still relying on adults or sleeping with their parents or not being in their own room, it might be a lifelong problem for them to develop that rhythm. But it's just so much easier, especially for some of our neurodevelopmentally challenged children, just let them sleep with you and to have that time to develop. And then, of course, their fixations. You know, they might be thinking, as I'm going to bed, can't wait to get back to Minecraft the next day, or I can't. And so now we also have forward thinking as well as backward thinking about what this was. And then a lot of our children talking about digestion, like Sean mentioned, a lot of serotonin is produced through the natural digestion of food. And in fact, maybe 98% or more of serotonin comes into that. And serotonin is important to calm that body. So depending on how they've eaten, what they've eaten, restricted food diets and things like that, they might not get that comforting feeling from serotonin, which might say, hey, you know, we're not ready to relax. Our body's still feeling a bit uncomfortable, which isn't going to send the message to the brain then to say, hey, pineal body up there, it's time to kick in some melatonin. We need to settle in and relax. And that also doesn't happen. And then, of course, any noises, you walk by the hall, the floor creaks or different lights. We have so many different dynamics happening with ASD individuals that a sleep study might say everything's normal, but we still have alerting and awaking factors that might come from other physiological mechanisms.
The sympathetic nervous system also can result in the higher heart rate or respiratory rates, all kinds of things that could have long-term health effects also, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. We know blood pressure, we don't want that staying up too high. That has really, really drastic effects on us as we get a little bit older. Heart rate too. Heart is a muscle, and the more we use it, the stronger it gets, the thicker it gets. And we know that can cause issues later on in life.
And the next thing here, there was a pyramid of learning, central nervous system. And that, again, is a visual. We'll have this slide presentation posted on our website. So you can hopefully take a look at that and get a good visual of what we're trying to describe verbally here. But could one of you explain the pyramid of learning?
Yeah, so it's got a couple different names. You might also come across it as the pyramid of development. This is some work done by Taylor and Troft. They started out as occupational therapists. I believe they went on to do some neuropsychology work and things like that. But the way it's kind of set up is in that pyramid fashion. So we have our foundation, and our foundation is sensation. And so we're looking at a couple different things. We're talking about taste, smell, sight, hearing, proprioception, touch. And that's really how our body starts, right? When we come out of the womb, our whole life is sensory. You know, that's non-negotiable. That's how we learn. That's how we interact. And as we come out, you know, we're just this little malleable piece of plastic. You know, we talk about that plasticity in the brain, and sensory is what really drives that. And so that's that foundation of that pyramid. As we go up, we start talking a little bit more about like sensory motor, awareness of our body, motor planning. Motor planning is a big one for me as an occupational therapist, the ability to conceptualize what we need to do to perform a given task. We start talking about like reflexes. We know that reflexes are really important in the development. And then above that sensory motor, we start talking about perceptual skills. So our ability to maintain our position in space, our posture. We know a lot of kiddos with autism have really poor posture. They maintain this forward flex position, curvature of the spine's real rounded. You know, they really have a hard time sitting up. And that kind of comes back to their tone also. And then that last piece of the development, that pyramid, is cognition and intellect. And so that's, you know, that's where we really start seeing the deficits in kiddos who might have autism, with their ability to learn, their behaviors, and their performance in what we call ADLs, activities of daily living. And that's where people really start picking up on them. We know diagnosis happens about 2.5, 3 years old. And that's because we start seeing some of those behavioral issues at the top of the pyramid. And then as an occupational therapist, my job is to kind of figure out, you know, I can look at this pyramid and say, hey, I think we're missing a block in the foundation. And a lot of times it comes back to that sensory component. Dr. Wolf talked a little bit about how it might affect sleep, right? The touch, the weighted blanket, things like that. And so my job is just to try to make sure that we have that foundation, and we look at these kiddos and try to fix things from the bottom up, you know, so I can plug in that foundation, fix it, and hopefully that helps improve performance.
And it helps a great deal when somebody has verbal skills.
Yeah. You know, that makes how my life
easier.
How do you
do it if you don't have the verbal skills? My son doesn't speak really, maybe a word or two.
But. Yeah. And you can, Dr. Wolf, jump in when you want. But yeah, so that definitely complicates things, right? But we also communicate through different ways, right? We can communicate through touch. We know that when someone isn't feeling safe and they're around someone who they trust, they might want to hug, right? And so there are other ways our body communicates with us, whether it's eye contact, postural, gesturing, things like that. But the ability to speak does make my life a little bit easier. I don't know if you have anything you want to add there.
Yeah, so a lot of times we have to really convince the parents that you are still our experts. You're our eyes, you're our ears. So even if you don't have language that's in an active, useful state, we can ask them, you know, what types of nonverbals the individual uses. Are they typically pulling or guiding? Are they pointing? When you point something, are they looking at options and giving you any nonverbals in terms of a smile or in terms of a head nod or anything that can help us to convey what they may be interested in? Or if we don't have some of those meaningful cues, sometimes the families will give us those hints of, okay, so here's how we typically, if they start to get frustrated, here's what we know they will respond favorably to. Here's what we know will typically cause them more frustration, because they've had that trial and error learning. Our job will be to keep advancing that individual, to push them up against areas where they might get frustrated and, you know, they're putting up kind of a developmental block. We're going to use a skill to try to make it easier for them to get over that block, whether it's in language or sensory motor. Activities of daily living, like we look at very actively in occupational therapy, to move into that place that feels uncomfortable, but to do so without either shutting down, becoming aggressive, or becoming non-compliant.
That's quite a balancing act.
Yeah, we call that finding the just right challenge.
The just right challenge?
The just right challenge, which is not easy to find a lot of times.
Because I just experienced as a parent, our son would give us some of the nonverbal communications that he wouldn't for you.
And that's where the parents become our experts. And a lot of times they're looking at us saying, well, you guys are the experts. When we're working with neurodevelopmental disorders, that is part of that family system. And for us to hopefully have the opportunity to intervene and help and guide a little bit faster, we need the experts that are coming in, which is usually the parents who are helping that guiding at first. But lots of times once the children then start to find that comfort zone clinically and in the space that they're in here, next thing you know, they might be grabbing your hand and going off with you. And the parents are like, okay, well, I guess we'll see you in a little bit then.
We crossed the bridge, didn't we?
Those are fun days.
I bet. Well, what else can you tell us about the couple slides you had on sensory processing disorder?
Yeah,
so skills development.
Yeah, so sensory processing disorder, and Dr. Wolf can speak a little bit to this. So it's not necessarily a recognized medical diagnosis, meaning you can't come to me for a sensory processing disorder and I can bill your insurance for it. You know, we're still not, it's more a subset of symptoms that falls under ASD. And so that challenge there, diagnosing it, a lot of times it's going to be an occupational therapist who might say, hey, I'm noticing some deficits in sensory processing. We might have a disorder here. But when we talk specifically about that, we kind of have an umbrella of some different ways that sensory processing disorder can go. The first one is a sensory modulation disorder. And the easiest way to think about it is the processing. That's when things come through the brain. The modulation is when our brain digests it and then figures out what we need to do with it. And we see sensory modulation disorder come out a couple different ways. A child can be over-responsive, meaning sensory stimulation comes in and they freak out or they overreact. We see a lot of under-responsivity, where that comes in and it just doesn't really register. They don't notice it. And, you know, that can be really important for survival, right? We use our eyes to find things in our environment that might be scary. Or even with taste, if we were to bite into something that might be moldy or spoiled, you know, our body's going to alert us and we're going to spit that food out. Someone who's under responsive, they might not get that. And so it can be super important in a couple different areas. And then that last piece for sensory modulation is the craving or the seeking, which we see a lot of. And we can see that craving and seeking towards specific stimuli. So a lot of times I have kiddos who are very proprioceptive seeking, meaning they want big movements. They like crashing into things. They like jumping. They like that input into the joints. Our joints have receptors in them that kind of help us tell our body where we are in space. And so that crashing is just a real big, heavy input. I have a big crash pad in the gym. And I would say nine out of 10 kids, the very first thing they do when they come into my room is they take off running and they jump right into that crash pad. And so, you know, that's a slight example of them seeking or craving that input.
And they could be future NFL players.
Right. Yeah they could
really
be.
They're pretty good at it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And then it kind of tears off into another area, and we call that sensory-based motor disorder. That's going to kind of display in their posture. So, you know, they might have the head kinked to the side all the time. They might be forward flexed. They really have a hard time. Their brain has a hard time telling where they are in space. And then the other part of that, and we see this pretty often, is dyspraxia. So just kind of a loss of ability to do a movement. That one's pretty common. And then we have sensory discrimination disorder. And this one's a little trickier, and it comes out a bunch of different ways. But for example, like for us sitting in here, if we were to hear a loud noise, I'm sure all of us could kind of point to where that noise was coming from, whether it's behind us, in front of us, below us. Someone who might have a discrimination disorder for auditory processing, you know, they might hear the noise, but they won't be able to tell us if it was very loud, where it was coming from. Their body can't discriminate against, you know, things like strength and things like that when it comes to stimuli.
Now, none of these can actually be cured. They can be treated, or you can alter the environment around them in order to give them something they can function with.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's very little cure going on here. But we can help the brain process things a little more efficiently. I love that you mentioned modifying the environment. You know, that's typically my first go-to, especially with parents in the home. You know, that's what we have the most control over as parents, is modifying the environment. If things are too bright, we can turn lights down. We can pull shades. If things are too warm or too hot, we can turn on the AC or a fan. And so I love that you mentioned that. That's really important when it comes to trying to compensate for sensory processing disorders.
A while back, I saw a video on the internet about, and there was some British company, I guess, made this about a child with autism in the mall, and the mom is using the ATM machine. Did you see that? Well, you're seeing the world through the child's eyes, and all of a sudden it gets really bright, and somebody drops something, you hear this loud crashing noise. And mom's talking to him, and all you can hear is blah, 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 and see the lips moving because he's focusing over here. And all these senses are coming at a different rate and different volume from all over the place. And then he kind of freaks out, and the next thing you see, it's black, and then he opens his eyes, and his mother's in front of him, getting him to calm down. And I've always wanted to live a day in my son's mind to see what he's seeing and understand what he's processing and dealing with. And that comes closest to it, to be able to see like that. It'd be great if we had a virtual reality experience that people could put the helmet on It's so much easier to understand at that point how to change the environment or how to respond to different stimuli that's coming in.
And we talk a lot about perception with my families, because I can't ultimately know how that child is perceiving things. You know, I'm like you said, I'm not in their brain. I don't know. And so perception is real for each individual. And I think that's also important to kind of keep in the back of my mind when I'm challenging kiddos and, you know, they look uncomfortable or they're really struggling. Sometimes I have to take a step back and realize, like, this is probably a little too much, you know, because I don't understand. I don't have the same perception that they do. And so I would love to see that commercial.
I'll send you the link. I'll find it and I'll send it to you. It's really amazing. There's a couple other things here that follow that slide. There's one on independence and ADLs and occupations. Maybe I'm skipping a little bit farther ahead here. We had gross motor and fine motor and visual.
Yeah, when it comes to motor skills, as an occupational therapist, that's kind of my niche. Gross motor skills, fine motor skills, they're all important for movement and engagement and what we call those ADLs.
Okay.
Gross motor, you know, that's more our ability to move our body through space, jump, run, things like that, balance. And then we have fine motor skills. Those are, you know, our ability to manipulate things with our hands, handwriting, putting little things together. We do see deficits in both those areas. Pretty common for kiddos with autism to have difficulties there. And that kind of comes back to things like the tone, the attention. Getting these kids to learn these things isn't always the easiest. I have to be pretty creative in how I set up a lot of my treatment sessions. When it comes to gross motor skills, you know, I think that's the most important thing for their main occupation, and that's play. Right?
Right.
We know through the age of 7, play is the most impactful thing we can have on the brain. And the most, it's going to be the most positive impact we can have on the brain. We kind of talk about that plasticity. That's what's going to help drive all those neural connections. You know, those good ones that we want is play. And so I want kids to be able to access their environment, especially when they're at school, on the playground, the monkey bars. I want them to be able to climb up ladders and go down slides, because it's so important for their development. And it's also important for them to interact similar to their peers, their neurotypical peers. A lot of times at recess, kiddos are getting left inside, not getting that interaction and that movement they need, or they're being singled out. You know, they might be last pick for activities outside. And so that's what I kind of pride myself on is helping them interact a little bit more with their environment through those gross motor skills. Yeah, so we did kind of skip over the motor skill development. We talk a little bit about milestones. You probably talk about it with pediatricians. And there's a reason why, you know, we're tracking those things. They really drive our movement. Reflexes are things that happen automatically. So we have a couple different ones. Pretty common one that most people understand is rooting. So if you take a baby and you kind of stroke the side of their cheek, they're going to turn their head that way. You know, that's really important for feeding, breastfeeding, mm-hmm. bottle feeding. It starts associating those two reactions. If someone touches my cheek, I'm going to turn my head that way. Then we start developing a little bit of hand-eye coordination through that way. We have reflexes that help us develop our rolling over, our crawling. And we know when those reflexes don't go away, we can't achieve those higher level movements, those gross motor and fine motor skills. And so some of the things we can do is some reflex integration. We can move kiddos through those patterns that they need to kind of help organize their brain so they can pick up on those higher level skills. I think it's most important for parents to kind of educate themselves on that. And for my younger kiddos, we definitely talk a lot about that. Just trying to figure out, you know, was crawling late, was walking late. That tells me a lot about their coordination. I know if a kiddo, like my own son, he skipped crawling. He started walking at about 11 months. And when I look at his movement,
overachiever.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't what he should have done, right? Our bodies are designed to crawl before we walk. And so when I look at his movement, he's not very coordinated. I don't think he's going to make it into the NFL. I don't think he's going to be a varsity athlete. I think he's going to be more a mathlete. He's super intelligent. But I look at that and I wish I would have done more for my son at that point. I'm going through college and things like that. You know, I feel like I missed out there. But there's a reason why those things are talked about with pediatricians and things like that.
Perhaps you should have a whole teaching thing on parental guilt about all the things we should have done and didn't do that we beat ourselves up for.
I like that.
Just let it go. No.
I like that.
Welcome back to the Unlocky Chat Cafe. I'm Carrie, your podcast co-host and head barista at the cafe. Our discussion today is centered on the first episode in a three-part effective parenting series presented by Brains in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Steve's here now, so let's get right to it. Steve, where do you want to begin?
Well, oddly enough, I want to begin at the end. There was one section that we did not cover in the interview, and it's overcoming barriers within the family dynamics. And I thought we'd take that from an experience that we have had raising our own son, because a lot of these seem to be fit very well with some of the experiences we've had with Liam. There's three areas, basically. Autism spectrum disorder has an impact on the various aspects of family life, which are primarily daily life, covers everything, relationships, and finances, employment.
That's pretty much all of it.
I can't think of a whole lot other than that. There's sleep, and actually it affects that too. But anyway, the first one is tips to reduce the stress of daily living skills. And okay. Again, I think we have a wealth of experience, although every family is going to be different. Depends upon where their child is in the spectrum and any other developmental disabilities also. But the first thing they recommend is create a consistent routine. And that's kind of easy to understand, because with autism, routines are something that people on the spectrum feel some comfort in.
Correct.
Sometimes when life is very hectic and we're heading in a different direction every minute, it's hard to see what the routine is. And that's a particular challenge that I have. And I think it's even more difficult when you have a child who is really more comfortable with routine, but routine is kind of sometimes a luxury for us.
You know, we do most routine, but sometimes that's not always easy to do, or something comes up and we have to have more flexibility than Liam would like. And that's where we try to then bear in mind how that affects him. And then that also has an impact on how long we can continue to do whatever this new situation is. And, you know, we try to not, you know, it's difficult, because it's not a matter of giving in to him. It's a matter of honoring he's reached maximum capacity.
I think most parents understand when the kids have hit the red line.
Yes. Other people don't get that, but
not with somebody else's kid. No, but we have that relationship. So we know when he's starting to hit the danger area.
Yes.
And I think most parents can understand that through some antecedent behavior.
Right. Right. Consistent routine is great. I like this next one. It's break the tasks down into small steps. Correct. And an excellent example of where we did that was going through the steps to get Liam to brush his teeth without us standing there and saying the whole thing. You took pictures of each step, and we have taped them to the bottom of his mirror so he can see them. And it's exactly the steps that need to take place for him to go from the beginning to the end of brushing his teeth.
In terms of patience, I think it works 70 to 80% of the time. But sometimes he starts picking up the last thing first, and it makes it a lot more difficult to go through the process.
But see, that's where you then, because we've used the visuals, and that's where you go to the modeling,
right,
prompting, and practice. Actually, the last couple of times when I have finished showering him and I've said, Liam, it's time to brush your teeth, he has gone right over to the sink and started. Now, he doesn't always start with the paper cup, because he uses a paper cup to rinse his mouth and he uses a ceramic cup to clean the sink and wet his toothbrush. So he fills two cups with water, and sometimes he starts with the paper one, sometimes he starts with the ceramic one. I don't care, as long as we get through the various steps. But it's great having the visual, because all I do is I just kind of
point,
right, and he'll attend and then move on. So it's great. And actually, in terms of helping model, it's really nice to break the steps down, because then that helps me figure out what's the best place to model and then scaffold. I love that phrase that we got picked up in one of our therapies was, so I'm just going to provide the platform for him to do the job. I like that.
And again, the small steps can apply to everything. It's not just brushing teeth. It could be many, many different things. And make it as simple as possible. Sometimes for some individuals, you might have to have 14 or 15 different steps. And Actually, in subsequent episodes of this interview with Brains, we talk about the next one is effective parenting for kids from age 0 to 10. And quite often in that process, too, they talk about training how to get things done and breaking it down and to take the cap off the toothpaste, blah, blah, blah. It could be very, very detailed, but it shouldn't be more detailed than it needs to be.
Right.
But the small steps makes it work a lot better.
Right. And then that all helps work towards independence in a specific area.
Right.
I mean, you know, when we talked about this, it was just like, okay, we want him to do all the bathroom stuff as independently as he can. We can't just start with that big whole room. So we have to start with a thing, one piece. And so we started with brushing the teeth. And then we also added washing your hands after using the toilet. And, you know, now he's gotten to the point where I'll say, Liam, what do you do now once he's back in his wheelchair? What do you do now, Liam?
That's kind of turning control over to him.
It is, but it's also, remember our steps. We did the steps enough times to say, okay, now you're done using the toilet. You need to wash your hands. Okay, let's go wash our hands now. And yeah, and so we did that. And we did the steps and we did the modeling and we did the scaffolding. Now, all I have to say is, Liam, what do you do now? Wash my hand. And I walk out of the room and he washes his hands. Woo!
That's exactly the way it should be, because when they get some kind of independence in a specific area, they're demonstrating expertise. That's got to feel good.
Oh, absolutely.
It's got to feel good because we're not on his back anymore about it. He can do this. He can do it by himself. And we've noticed that over the years, how he's picked up certain skills and we just let him do it. If it isn't exactly the way I'd want to have it done, it's still getting done.
Right.
And that's where you just kind of back off.
Right.
And be happy about it.
That's part of the grace we talk a little bit later.
Right.
Next, I think a really good piece here, especially at the beginning of the training process and the consistent routines, is you need to provide breaks and calming strategies before you get to the problem behavior. You know, when you see that he's already getting agitated about filling the cups, and you know, let's get the calming behavior. Let's have that strategy built into our process of training him so we don't get the big old meltdown.
In the interest of true confessions, I have to admit that sometimes the calming strategy is for mom and dad. I have noticed over the years how Liam's behavior kind of depends upon my attitude or my level of stress. He's very perceptive, and I think most kids are extremely perceptive.
Oh, yeah.
And they can tell when you're having a bad day, or you're even if you've got a smile on your face, that's not the vibes you're sending off. Mm. And so sometimes that providing breaks and calming strategies is a matter of like, I see my son starting to redline, or you know what? I've got to take a couple of deep breaths, relax, and reapproach and do it calmly and slowly. And then you get better results out of it.
Yep.
The next one is support advocacy. And I think we have to be advocates, but we also have to see where somebody else is supporting advocacy on a particular issue, getting behind the right causes and the right people. And I love celebrating small victories, which is number 7. It's nice to be recognized for doing something. And we have to assume that no matter how verbal or engaged our child might be, if you're celebrating their achievement on something, that is one way to reduce stress.
Yep.
And the next area was tips to reduce the stress on relationships, as if there's any stress in relationships in a family with a child with ASD. Create positive interactions with all family members by pairing. What that basically means is this. Our youngest child, our producer, Alex, when he was around 4 or 5 years old, naturally became a little bit jealous of the attention that Liam got. Liam was using a wheelchair. Liam got more attention, and Alex a couple times would sit in Liam's wheelchair and say, I wish I had cerebral palsy. Now, it's not that we were ignoring him. Those are natural jealousies because of the amount of behavior or amount of attentions paid to one child over another. But
Even though that attention was therapy,
right?
Or like exercises.
Liam was really enjoying himself.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just like,
not a matter of taking him out for ice cream and leaving Liam and Alex at home. It's just a matter of sometimes that extra attention has to be paid. And pairing sometimes might be dad and daughter go out for lunch, or maybe mom and son do something, child without the disability is getting special attention also. That helps in relationships.
Right.
Then developing appropriate scripts and routines.
Social scripts.
Social scripts. You know, there are, I'm very aware of the fact that there are things that you will do with Liam that are very different than what I do. We try to be consistent with that, but sometimes we're not using the same script for appropriate social behaviors, and we're not following the same routines. And I want to say over and over again in this, just give yourself some grace. You're going to fail at this stuff. You know, it's none of us are perfect, okay? So there's always a reset button, and you can always give yourself a little grace, and we'll try it again. And I know there's times when I've seen you do something with Liam that I'm not normally involved with, and or I do differently, and I say, wow, that works really well. I'm going to change what I do. And now all of a sudden, our scripts became more common, and our routines become more common. The more you can do that, the better all the results you'll get. Set boundaries and expectations for behaviors. I think that's really important, that we have boundaries and expectations.
Oh, sure.
And that they're commonly held with
exactly.
Parents.
I mean, one of our bugaboos with Mr. Liam is that he will sometimes come to the dinner table quite willingly, and sometimes he decides to basically have a bloody fit at the table. And while I will allow very many things to go on, I will not allow him to sit there and scream at me at the table or just scream at the table. So that's where we've said, no, no, if you want to sit at the table and have dinner with us, you can't yell. If you're going to yell, go in your room. He has gone in his room and slammed his door. I think that's exceedingly appropriate.
Well, it's something we'd like him to grow out of, but...
But it's appropriate. He's angry about something, and he is expressing it.
And it's not always about dinner, either, because the amazing thing is sometimes he'll go away indignantly, screaming, and then come back 5 minutes later, and he's hungry. And it's like, okay, now it's on my terms. I'm joining you at the table. So I think that's part of it. One of it is right. we ask him to come to the table, and the other one is he decides to come to the table.
Right, but we've said you can't come here with that behavior or that attitude.
That's the boundary.
And that's our boundary. And he does all right with it. He really does. But, you know, again, that works well with dinner. You have to look at the function that's happening and then figure out the skill that you're going to teach, and then you have to provide reinforcements. And I like you have a little note here that you provide a reinforcement, not a bribe. And tell me that.
Yeah, the reinforcement, not a bribe. When I listened, I participated in this presentation that Brains did before we did the recording, obviously. They came up with that idea, and it all of a sudden I realized when I was bribing and when I was reinforcing. And reinforcing would be, like for Liam, if it's a matter of him having television time after we have lunch or something like that, I say, Liam, let's have lunch right now, and then I'll put the remote control down. He says, and then you get this. Okay. Now, that's a reinforcement. It's a bribe if he's having a holy fit about eating lunch. And I said, if you calm down, then you can have some TV. Because what we're telling him is, if I want TV, pitch a fit. And then they'll give me a bribe. So, and, you know, that is lost on me initially, but now I see it's very, very effective because he complies with the request. Okay, we're going to have lunch now, and then you can have this and watch some TV. And I have to give him the remote, because just saying you can watch TV doesn't do it. When he sees the remote, that's a reality.
Yeah, well, and that's part of his total communication.
Right. So I think, you know, the no bribe, but reinforce, I think is a very great way to reduce stress in relationships. I have seen a noticeable difference when taking that strategy with him.
Right, right. So very good.
Then once skills are taught, follow through. Don't let up on it. You know, we still say, Liam, it's time to brush teeth, and we still watch the procedure he's using. Hopefully there'll become a day when he'll just do that without being prompted.
Right.
But it hasn't happened yet. It's
he's
only
getting
been
better with the washing the hands. So,
yes, he has.
You know, it's all a goal. It's all
but
a goal.
It's only been a year and a half with the teeth, and he's only 32, so we'll get there. The next one, tips to reduce the stress of transitions. Oh, again, this is effective for all people. Utilize resources and ask questions. Sometimes we think that, gee, if you ask a question, you might appear to be stupid. Hey, I don't mind if people think that I'm stupid as long as I'm getting the right answers and it helps me. That's fine. Put the ego aside. You know, utilize the resources that are available. Seek them out, especially when you know there's a transition coming up and maybe it's puberty or maybe it's moving from one school to another. Find out what your resources are, ask questions, and get advice. And then the second one was advocate, advocate, advocate. I'm not stuttering there. Basically, that advocating is always saying, what's best for my child? Where do I find the answers? How do we do this? How do I get what I need? And then sharing that information with other parents too, because that's how we accumulate a body of intelligence about different issues is by sharing things that work and things that don't work and sharing the resources. Where did you find that out? Oh, I went to Brains. You know, that's, boy, I don't pick a dentist out without getting a referral from somebody. When it comes to our kids, when it comes to advocating, it's great to ask.
Right. And sometimes it's a matter of actually going and walking the terrain that's going to be the next move too.
Yes.
That kind of falls under a little bit of the accept help.
Part of that is, you know, you talk about walking the train, going through the new school. We may, as parents, have a better idea of what is going to work and what is going to be challenging in terms of a new routine. Yeah, and walking through that, literally walking through and seeing, maybe spending a day there when school is in session, if it's possible, gives us an idea how our child is going to adapt to something and what might be problematic area.
Right.
So I think that's really, really good. It's mm-hmm. important. Mm-hmm. Accept help. God, is that hard sometimes?
Sometimes it is, yeah.
I know some parents that are at the breaking point, and you almost have to restrain them and say, take a break. But they think, well, self-care is selfish. And I always maintain, self-care is refueling your tank. Mm-hmm, because of when right. you run out of gas and you start getting testy and emotionally drawn, you're not doing anybody any good. You're not being a good mom. You're not being a good dad.
Right.
You're not being a good husband or a spouse or a partner. At that point, you're not good for anybody, really.
Right.
So you've got to take breaks. And accepting help is part of that.
Yep.
You know, you can't do it all yourself. You don't get any rewards or any medals for that.
No, no. The other thing, piece about that is I had an instance where I was loading Liam into the car. And first, I would put the child in the car.
I remember this.
And then I would put the wheelchair in the back of the vehicle. And a gentleman was walking by as I was getting ready to do that. And he said, oh, well, can I help you with, can I do that for you? And you know what? Quite honestly, I know that I could do it. I do it all the time. I do it 10, 15, 20 times a day. You know, it doesn't really take me that long. I've got a routine. But I heeded the advice and I accepted the help. Now, it took him a lot longer than it would have taken me to load that wheelchair into my car. But what I saw was there were two things that occurred there. You know, first of all, I got a break from doing it. Okay. but the second piece of it was, you know, when he finally got it in there and we arranged and everything, and he's like, wow. That was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be.
Ah, education takes
and
place.
What? Yes. Yes.
That's why we have handicap spots.
Yes. And, you know, so I thought, okay, so I have now helped in this man's education. The next time he sees somebody doing this, he might be intimidated to offer help, but he will acknowledge that that is quite a task that they're doing flawlessly, effortlessly, like that. So
I think one of the definitions of grace is accepting help when you don't necessarily need it, but somebody else needs to offer help, because not for ableist reasons.
If
but
you
they're
can
doing
afford
it because
it.
They really,
yeah.
Yeah, if you can afford the time. But if somebody really wants to help, maybe that day they just feel that they need to do something for somebody.
Yeah, but you know, now you're getting into a little bit of the conversation that we had with
Beth Heller.
Yes,
and, no, I'm saying not ableist. He asked
area.
You. He says, "May I help
yes.
you with that?"
Yes.
And
yes.
sometimes maybe he just felt that he had to help somebody today because it also helps him. Grace is actually accepting help or accepting advice that wasn't solicited, but you know that it's beneficial for the other person to be able to do that. Mm. And it's educational, not that it's our responsibility to educate the world, but it's something that sometimes we have to do.
Right. So our number four is plan early and often.
Yes.
For your transitions.
Because sometimes the first plan doesn't work, or you have to amend it and a plan. This is plan 2.475, because number 1, 2, it didn't work, so we just have to do it again. But really, I've the standard joke I have with people is, yes, we can live spontaneously as long as we have a 2-week advance notice.
Right.
And I think that's true with anybody that has an individual in their family with a special need that requires special circumstances.
Yep.
Spontaneity is not, it's not something in our orbit. We don't even recognize that. It happens occasionally, but it's rare.
Right.
The next thing here, be involved in IEP meetings. Now, we all know you have to be involved in IEP meeting because it's not always a collaborative effort. Sometimes it's a little bit more of a contentious.
Adversarial.
I can think of some of those words.
Yeah.
We can go over, we could probably spend an hour talking about ones we've had in the past where they had 9 people on their side of the table and you better have 9 on yours because it's kind of a power play. But also because the IDEA, the Individual with Disabilities Education Act, requires transition goals be identified as your child prepares to leave the public school system. And obviously, when you have one child, you have one shot at this. And I can't say our experiences have been, but our experience was that there was really no transition planning done at all.
Oh, no, even though I started asking when he was 16 years old, knowing that he had until maximum age 26. And I started asking at 16, what's the transition plan? What does that look like? What are the options? What is out there? As it happened, when Liam was getting closer to his actual transitioning out of the public school system, there were so many budget cuts and things going on that it was really hard to even come up with a plan because they're like, well, we used to do this, but that may not be there. You know, so it was this horrific fluid blob of I don't even know what's going to be available with a child that really needs to have structure and a process and right. a lead time. And you know, it was just like, you guys are not hearing me at all.
And the impression that I got, and I know you did too, is that you're in the school system, you're on this side of the fence. Okay. When you get to be 26 in Michigan, where if you're listening from some other state, it might be 21. But when you're at the end of that school experience, they take you to the fence and then somebody from the other side of CMH picks you up or community mental health. And now there's a transition. But the world changes and they didn't prepare you for that.
Exactly. And you keep saying, what is this going to do? What does this look like? And
I remember hearing that.
The school
that,
side.
Well, they just said, well, at 26, then CMH takes over.
Right. They don't even know what the other side right. does. And side B is like, well, we really don't talk to you until you're over here. It's like.
Now, that was specific to our county. I know there's other counties in Michigan where they have very successful transition
yes,
programs.
Yes.
And we need to work on that for our own home.
So go back to the plan early and often. So start asking at 16. Start asking at 18 and say, what does this look like?
Transition plans don't happen at 25 and a half. Although I've heard many people say that. That's when they thought it started. It's supposed to start before 18. Actually, around 16, something like that.
Right.
A person-centered plan is something that's required after age 18. But you could have one before that. It's just a matter of, you know, we'll have a whole section on person-centered plans, another episode. Then we have tips to reduce the stress that can accompany behaviors.
All right.
Do you think that Liam has any behaviors that cause stress? Maybe meltdowns in the middle of public places. You know, that can happen. But number one is determine what's most important and stick to it. I kind of like the old saying about what hill do you want to die on?
Right.
Is it worth it? Okay. Right. Is it just a matter of I will prevail and there's going to be a lot of collateral damage because I've got to win at this one? Mm-hmm. No. You've got to be able to say some things you have to let go of. What is the most important? And then, like we already said, break it down into different steps, et cetera. But when it comes to behaviors, there's things that are acceptable and things that are not acceptable. Don't attempt to change everything is number two. You know, it's hard for any neurotypical person to change every aspect of their life. Work together and respond consistently. One thing that I think our kids are brilliant at is spotting differences between mom and dad or brother or sister or grandma and grandpa and exploiting that, whether they have ASD or not. All kids are really good at that. But they do need some consistency, getting back to patterns and behaviors.
Right.
It makes things far more predictable, and it reduces their stress. And number four is share the burden.
Share the burden.
Right. This gets down to the relationships between parents and other adult authorities within the family. Sometimes sharing the burden doesn't mean that, okay, we're going to set the table. I'm setting three dishes out and you set three dishes out. It might be that I will cook the dinner and if you could do this part, things happen easier.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
So sharing the burden doesn't mean splitting things down the middle, nor does it mean that you're keeping score. Because if you do that, it's going to be a big problem. You don't win. Everybody loses when you're trying to keep score. It should be something which is done willingly. The last one, therefore, stresses that can accompany behaviors is give space when needed.
So what exactly do you mean by that?
I'm a great fan of Brené Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of her books, she talked about her and her husband, how one of them can be feeling great and without communicating, not realize that the other spouse on an energy level of 1 to 10 or frustration level is maybe at 3.
I can handle this. I can take it all. No problem.
You know what? The other one's not. And there could be some there might not be accurate communication on that.
Right.
So they developed a way to be able to say on particular days, where are you at? Her husband's name is Steve, which is really cool because it's a great name. But you'll say, Steve, where are you at today? And he'll say, well, I'm a 7. And she's, well, I'm about a 9. So now you're saying, okay, I need to give a little bit more in this relationship. I need to help a little bit more. And as long as you're not being exploitive of the situation, but you're being honest, it can really help with stresses that come up because of behaviors with kids, because maybe you have a lot more resiliency today than I do.
Right.
And
right.
I noticed you've, without me even communicating it, you'll come along and say, here, let me do that. Because you can see that I'm about to, implode.
You've got so many things going on and you have all these things that you want to do and la, 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 and it's not been working out that way because, oh my gosh, we all know that you get up in the morning and it's like, hey, I plan on getting these 3 things done. Actually, I'm going to get 5 done because I have that much energy. And maybe you get 2 and you're kind of irritated because all this other stuff kept buttoning in the way. So if you understand that at the beginning of the day it may not be at the beginning. Maybe it'll be, in the middle of the day and you're just like, you know what? I'm at a 2 right now and this is not working well for me. It's like, okay, gotcha. I can step in here and do some of these things. So don't worry about it. I've got that energy. I can do that.
And sometimes later in the day might be an 8 because you took some time to regenerate. And again, it's self-care. Yeah. That's really important.
Cool. So yeah, give space when needed.
Yep.
Accept space when you must.
Do
it. Back away.
Right. Absolutely.
It's important.
But I think the emphasis there is the communication between the adults in the room.
Right.
Basically.
Excellent.
And other.
What a neat, also another great model for our kids to see.
Yeah.
Because like you said, they're very perceptive. They are understanding that you're kind of at your wit's end here and, you're kind of barking a little bit and I don't like that feeling. But mom's not barky so much, so I'm going to go more over this way. So it shows them that sometimes you can take space. You can say, I'm just going to go in my room and chillax for a little bit because I don't feel good. I don't feel good energy. Or whatever you want to call
right.
it.
Right. Little self-care, a little recharge. It's kind of like when you're tired and you really need a power nap. Give me 30 minutes and I'm fine. And you wake up 30 minutes later and I'm ready to take on the world. Everything changes.
Right. Cool.
The last one in terms of tips is tips to reduce employment and financial stress. Now, obviously, there are some things within your control. It's always within your control to ask for flexibility, things like that. But depending upon your job and who you work for, you'll have varying results on this. But that's not an excuse for not asking.
Exactly.
Number one is request flexibility and explain why. Let them know why. If it's a small company and they understand your situation, it might work better. But even in a larger company, the chances are you're going to find somebody else in management or in a decision-making capacity above your own that has a child with ASD or a nephew or a brother or sister.
Or knows someone, yeah.
Right. So,
but explaining why it's needed is really important.
Focus on what your child needs, not what you can give just because what's left over. So, yeah, there's got to be give and take on that. But if your son or daughter always comes in second or third place because of the job, that is communicating a message you don't want to communicate to your child and to your other children, your neurotypical children also. So it's a balancing act. It certainly is. Set reasonable expectations and give yourself grace. This is under financial stress and employment stress. Sometimes you have to set reasonable expectations in terms of what you can achieve on the job and what maybe you need to ask for a longer due date on something or additional help. Find a support group. From a male perspective, I thought support groups were for people that were weak. There were times we walked into a support group and they got boxes of Kleenex out, and that does not appeal to me because I want to focus on solutions. I want to share frustrations, but I don't want to nurse things that have gone wrong, although there is value to that, okay? I think support groups are more of a positive thing now. I look at it as being support is not to help me stand up, it's to help me move forward, and I see that as a more important thing. Virtual or in person, because right now it's hard to find in a pandemic a safe place for groups of parents to get together.
Right.
It's okay to get away. And my own note here I put down, it's required to get away once in a while. It gets back to self-care. Brains has provided parents with date nights in the past. Now, we don't live close to Brains. We're about 45 or 50 minutes away, so we've never looked into taking advantage of that. So there's other organizations. There's churches that offer some respite, and that might just be like 4 hours or 2 hours to go to a movie or something. Take advantage of it, and then give back and help the next person.
Right.
I think it's required. Respite. Second thing here was respite providers, camps, and home help. And again, getting back to advocacy, at least in our county, I know, because we've been told, do you want more respite? Respite hours? We can have more if you'd like. And we have not reasonably seen where we could take advantage of that, but ask for more respite time. And don't do it with hat in hand. Say, you know what? We really need some additional respite hours.
Right.
Ask. Tell them what you need. The worst thing they can do is say no, but then you can tell them again, but we really need this.
Right.
Yeah. Advocate.
Yeah.
Ask about scholarships and resources. Many different organizations that offer therapies and other services that might not be covered by insurance do have scholarships that they can offer some help on a tuition or a fee.
Right. Or even it goes back to the flexibility. They might have some flexibility in their scheduling that would make it more affordable for you. I don't want to come every day. I don't think my child could tolerate that. Do you have something where we could maybe come twice a week?
And an example of that would be horseback riding therapy. Sometimes Liam is very much into it. Other times and other seasons, he's not so much, but we know there's a benefit to it. And there have been times where we have shared with another family. Okay, there's 12 lessons coming up.
Right.
How about you do every other one and we do every other one, and it cut the cost in half. The therapy organization was more than willing to help us with that. And if we didn't have a partner family, they would probably find one for us.
Right. So ask.
You know,
you'd be amazed at what actually ends up happening and comes about. It's absolutely really neat. So do you have any other aha moments to share, Steve?
You know, Dr. Michael and Sean covered a lot of area, and it's some very, very important stuff. This is an episode you can listen to several times and pick up new things each time you do that. Helped with a great deal of understanding. And I'm not going to go through all of them because we're going to make this an awful long chat cafe. But there's three things that were, I guess I knew, but surprising the way it manifests. There's three different levels of classification for ASD. Number three is requiring very substantial support. Then there's level two, requires substantial support, and level one requires support. In the interview, I asked him, was there a 2.75 that maybe happens on Mondays? Because it's not always consistent. And, you know, Dr. Wolf said, it's where you seem to have the most problems. You know, maybe it is 2.5, but we count that as a three or something at that point. So, and that's fluid because it can move, okay?
Well, yeah.
And unfortunately, there's a financial aspect to that, too, because some things are covered by insurance and some things are not. So
depending on the level.
Right. Depending if someone's at level one and they require some support, can't be documented in terms of the school system that this is going to help them educationally, although they need the social support, you're probably not going to get extra resources for that.
Right.
There is the second thing was a mind-body connection. And everybody's familiar with the term hangry. When you're hungry, you can become angry because it affects your moods. Okay, that is part of the mind-body connection.
Ah, okay.
There's things that we can have some control over. And especially if you know that, okay, we're going to eat in an hour, it's harder to explain that to a child with autism who has a need that needs to be met right now. and it causes a lot of stress in them. The basic ones are sensory, and we know that that can be a huge effect with somebody with autism. Digestive, yes, there are digestive issues, mm-hmm. sometimes because of levels of stress. Muscular, ability to have control over certain areas. That's where PT and OT help. And sleep is a huge thing because of the rhythms of sleep that people go into sometimes are disruptive. Right. That happens far more frequently with someone who has ASD.
Okay.
And then some things we see as just being, well, disruptive behavior or not obeying has a physiological reason behind it.
Right.
And we're not understanding that. And it's a lot sometimes to ask our parents to be understanding in all situations. But if you're aware of that and you put it on your radar, maybe we can be a little bit more attuned to it. Maybe we can back off and take our deep breaths.
Or be more accommodating to the situation and figuring out a way to calm down.
Yeah.
So we don't have that anxiety level up there.
The last thing that kind of broke my heart, and Dr. Michael says this happens quite a bit, is somebody who might be in level one, which means that they can talk about how they feel. They're verbal. They might express things differently than the rest of us do. However, they're complaining about something, and then they get treated for bipolar disorder. They get medication, and it makes them feel crappy. And this has been going on for years with them, and they weren't diagnosed properly with ASD. So then when they are diagnosed, these individuals, young adults, have a tendency not to have a high degree of trust because I told you before this was a problem and nobody listened to me. I asked him in the interview, how often does that happen? He says, all the time.
Mm, wow.
It's a little bit easier when you see somebody that manifests autism physically in the way they behave.
In a typical manner.
In a typical manner. In somebody who is a high-functioning Asperger's and is not able to be understood and they're not really diagnosing it properly. So that breaks my heart that they've been treated
incorrectly.
Maybe for perfectly good reasons, but they were misdiagnosed.
And then that just, wow. And then the lack of trust that follows. Yeah. Wow.
Okay. That's about it for the episode. Please check out our website and Facebook pages for the PowerPoint that was created for this presentation. We're going to place that in there and you can follow along with that and in many cases see exactly what they're talking about in terms of resources. We'll also have a list of treatments and resources and a video or two that we reference in the episode. So please check that out. I think you'll find it very helpful. So you want me to take us out?
Sure.
Okay, credits. We want to thank our producer and newlywed son, Alex, the youngest spawn of the Johnson clan. Alex and his life partner were married in a small private ceremony in our home on New Year's Eve.
Ooh.
There's no excuse for ever forgetting your anniversary. And the whole world's celebrating with you by having a party. We also thank Holly, our web czar and artistic director. Danielle Munoz is our intern who does a little bit of everything in terms of coming up with creative ideas and better ways to do things. And she performs some of the tedious tasks that nobody else wants to do. And we want to thank you, our listeners, because if you weren't listening, we wouldn't be speaking and there would be no podcast. We invite your participation, suggestions, and feedback. Look us up on Facebook and post your comments, please. So with that, let's say
thank you for listening.